Hey, that was great. I always love to hear that theme. So, good evening. I'm Patricia Lynch. I'm the executive director here, and I'm the creator and executive producer for Writers on a New England Stage. And we are in for a fantastic evening tonight. I've got to say, the 5 o'clock show was absolutely inspiring. Because tonight we are welcoming the celebrated author, Greg Mortensen. And it is an honor. His book, Three Cups of Tea, has been a fixture on the New York Times bestseller list for more than 3 years. Mr. Mortensen is truly a humanitarian. He's also a former mountaineer and the co-founder of the not-for-profit Central Asia Institute. Mr. Mortensen is here to discuss his latest work, Stones into Schools. This dramatic first-person narrative picks up where Three Cups of Tea left off in 2003, recounting his tireless, ongoing efforts to establish schools in the secluded northeast corner of Afghanistan. As did Three Cups of Tea, it follows another of Mortensen's promises and the work of the Central Asia Institute to launch schools into the heart of Taliban country. Also on the job at moments, Mortensen has helped the U.S. military formulate new strategic plans for the region. This evening, Mr. Mortensen will be making a 25-minute presentation, complete with pictures. After that, he's going to be interviewed by Laura Canoy, host of New Hampshire Public Radio's award-winning call-in show, The Exchange. Laura Canoy, of course, is a radio veteran who's worked as a newscaster and reporter for National Public Radio, and in 2007 was named New Hampshire Broadcaster of the Year. For the last 14 years, she's been the host of New Hampshire's only statewide call-in radio show, The Exchange. Throughout the coming year as we would get to know Greg Mortensen, but it's only an hour, folks. All right. And we're going to get to know Greg and his work, our house band, Dreadnought, and again, they're just great. They'll be playing Greg Mortensen's themed music. And if you have a question you'd like Laura Canoy to ask Greg Mortensen during her interview, please jot it down on the index cards we handed out when you entered, hand it to an usher. We're going to answer just as many as we have time for. Now, those of us who work on Writers on a New England Stage, we are committed to bringing you the best and most thought-provoking new literature and celebrating the life of the mind. Since the series launch in 2005, this has been a triumvirate. The Music Hall, New Hampshire Public Radio, and River Run Bookstore. Together, we've introduced Music Hall audiences and New Hampshire Public Radio listeners to nearly 24 writers. The series has been a real success for us and our visiting authors, and it struck a chord with audiences, and the media has taken note. Now I have an announcement to make. One national print publication in particular has stepped forward to salute the series and lend its support. We've gained as a partner Yankee Magazine. They're based across the state in Dublin, New Hampshire, but in touch with 2 million print readers and more online. Starting immediately, they'll be promoting the series to their readers and building us a home on their website. It's a partnership we're all excited about. So I know you'll want to give them that warm Writers on a New England Stage welcome, and we really appreciate all of our partners. So thank you to all of our partners. They'll be giving Yankee magazines away tonight as a gift to celebrate this. And we look forward to many great writers' nights ahead. But we also tonight want to thank and really welcome the many school groups we have here in the audience, as well as the book clubs. There's also volunteers from Passports to Peace and Pennies for Peace. And I think you've seen these brochures, these magazines, Journey of Hope. This is from the Central Asia Institute, and they're building awareness and fundraising for Greg Mortensen's efforts. So I hope you'll take a moment to look through them. I also want to acknowledge our sponsors. Please, if you'll hold your applause, particularly our evening sponsor, Measured Progress, and our series sponsor, Ogier Building Company, Inc., Calypso Communications, New England Audio Tech, Piscataqua Landscaping Company, RMC Research Corporation, Haunted Milk Design, and Popovers and Galley Hatch Hospitality Group. And New Hampshire Public Radio would like to thank their sponsor, Heinemann. So let's give them a little thanks, too. But let me do a special shout-out. I want to acknowledge our members, our music hall members, and the members of New Hampshire Public Radio, because it's you that make programs like this possible. So thank you so much. Writers on a New England Stage with Greg Mortensen will air the exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio on Wednesday, December 9th. So if you have friends and family who weren't able to get into the music hall, please direct them to that program. Now, about Greg Mortensen's book. Backstage this afternoon, Mr. Mortensen signed copies of Stones Into School for those in the audience who bought book vouchers in advance through the music hall and River Run bookstore. Lucky you, you got that book at a 10% discount. A gift back from the Music Hall and River Run Bookstore. If you have a voucher and have not, and you will pick up your book tonight in the downstairs lobby, or there's a book table where you can purchase a voucher and get a book. Now, you know that a signed book is a great addition to everyone's library, and this is the holiday season, so wow, what a gift. Now, please, in the spirit of shop local, would you buy your books for Writers on a New England Stage here at the Music Hall or at River Run Bookstore? I love you, audiences. You just get it. Back to tonight. I have two favors. Would you just turn off all those jingly, jangly, bibbity, boppity things? They're called cell phones, all right? And then would you, no photos, okay? Thank you. And now, would you please join me in welcoming Greg Mortensen?
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you so much. And again, I'd like to thank the Music Hall and New Hampshire Public Radio and the River Run Bookstore. They've been working really hard. I'd also like to thank the many volunteers in the back. I think you're all back there, so let's give all the volunteers a big round. Thank you. And Patricia, thank you for opening up. Patricia, I first saw her when I first came in, and she had on cowboy boots. I'm from Montana, so I thought, boy, I'm right back at home now. So, also, thanks to Tom Holbrook and Laura, who will be hosting the interview a little bit later on. And again, I'd like to thank the Dreadnought Band for the incredible music. They'll play a little bit afterwards. Thank you very much. I'd also like to thank all of you. I'd like to thank the veterans here. I'd like to thank the librarians and teachers and the community and the students here. The many places of worship and the AUW and all the different civic groups. Thank you so much for all your help. I'll be talking about 25 minutes. And first of all, I just want to check how many of you read Three Cups of Tea. Okay. All right. Maybe we'll tell a different story then. And you're probably familiar with the title. It's in honor of a village chief, Haji Ali, in Pakistan. He told me that if you really want to do business in Pakistan, you need to drink three cups of tea. The first cup, you're a stranger. Second cup, a guest. And the third cup, you become family. But what you might not know is when I picked the title, but the publisher picked the subtitle of the original book. And they said they wanted to be one man's mission to fight terrorism one school at a time. And although I'm a military veteran, I was very opposed to that. So they insisted on it. So finally I went to New York and I summoned a JIRGA. It's like a tribal conference. And it was my first time in New York. And you know, I had to meet with the CEO and the head of marketing and head of publicity. So I very eloquently tried to say why I want the subtitle to be One Man's Mission to Fight or to Promote, promote peace once upon a time. Well, when I got down, they said, Greg, we understand what you're trying to say, but this is your first book, and you need to learn a couple things about the publishing industry. Only 1 out of 8 books makes a profit, and 2/3 of all bestsellers are pre-chosen by the publisher. So we'd like to promote your book, but we need you to be fighting terrorism so we can pitch the media, and then your book will do well. Well, finally, I conceded, but if you work in Pakistan or Afghanistan for a while, you learn that you never settle a deal without driving a hard bargain on the side. Probably here in New Hampshire, same kind of thing. So the hardcover came out in 2006, and it didn't do very well for a year, and I kept plugging for the change of subtitle. And so finally, in January 2007, they changed the subtitle of the book, and now it's been a New York Times bestseller for 144 weeks in a row. You know, fighting terrorism, or even those who promote terrorism, that is based in fear. But promoting peace is based in hope. And the real enemy that we all face, whether it's in Africa or Afghanistan or here in America, the real enemy is ignorance. And it's ignorance that breeds hatred. And to overcome ignorance, we have to have compassion. And I think we need courage. And most of all, I think it's really about education. Well, I was very lucky. I was born in Minnesota, and if you want to label me, I'm basically a Minnesota Norwegian Lutheran. I don't know if any fellow of you out there. But when I was 3 months old, my parents went to Africa where they taught in a girls' school. And my father ended up starting a hospital called the Kilimanjaro Christian Medical Center. It was a very wonderful place to grow up. I got to go to school with children from 24 countries. I got to go to school with Muslims and Jews and Christians and Hindus and Sikhs and Buddhists. And my father worked very hard to get the Kilimanjaro Christian Medical Center set up. One thing, though, my father always insisted on was having local people in charge. And sometimes that didn't go over very well with the Americans or Europeans. They said, you need a qualified Westerner to run the hospital. My father insisted that an African run the hospital. And finally, the hospital opened up in 1971, and my father got up and gave a speech, and he said that he had a little prediction to make that in 10 years, all the department heads of the hospital would be from Tanzania. Well, afterwards, he basically got laid off for saying that and having the audacity to believe that a hospital could actually be run by the local people. We came back to the States, and unfortunately, my father died in his late 40s from cancer in 1980. But we got the annual report from the hospital 10 years later, and all the department heads were from Tanzania. And even today, 38 years later, all the department heads of the hospital are from Tanzania. And I think it's an important lesson about the people can be empowered, and we have to have faith and confidence that people really themselves can be empowered to determine their own outcome. Well, in Africa, as a child, I learned a proverb. You can see it behind, if you can read, it's right behind me here. If we educate a boy, we educate an individual, but if we can educate a girl, we educate a community. So how do the gentlemen feel about that here? And how do the women feel about it? Oh, okay. Gentlemen, I think we're a little bit outnumbered here. Well, finally came time to come back to the States. I was in high school. I was very excited. I wanted to play football and have 4th of July's and fireworks and Cracker Jacks. But my first day in high school in St. Paul, Minnesota, and this picture you can see is a little bit outdated here. If anybody has a picture of St. Paul High School, please send it to me. But my first day in high school, I got beat up. It was because I made a mistake. I said I'm African, and there was some confusion about that. But you know, it was actually the first time in my life that I learned what the word racism meant. It was actually not in Africa, but it's here in the U.S. Well, we were quite poor, so 4 days after high school, in June of 75, I did something very unpopular at the time. I joined the U.S. Army, and I did it for 2 reasons. Number one, I wanted to serve my country, and number two, I wanted the GI Bill so I could go to university. And it was actually in the military where I met young men and women from all across the U.S. It made me appreciate that we are a great country, not because of our commonality, but because of our great diversity. In Three Cups of Tea starts out with my youngest sister, Krista. And Krista was very special. It was because she had severe epilepsy. And she never complained. She would spend an hour or two the night before school, get her lunch lined up and packed and her clothes lined up. And I'm kind of five-minute bed to bus kind of guy. Anyways, in 1992, Krista saw the baseball movie called Field of Dreams, and she was very inspired by the movie. So for her 23rd birthday, she was going to drive from the Twin Cities down to Dyersville, Iowa, to see where the movie Field of Dreams was filmed. And she packed her bags, but when my mother went to wake up Krista July 24th, 92, Krista died in her sleep from a very massive seizure. And at the time, I was a graduate student. I was studying neurophysiology, epilepsy. I was working as a trauma nurse. I also was climbing quite a bit. So I decided to honor Krista. I would climb K2, the world's second highest mountain, and put her amber necklace on top of the mountain in her memory. Finally, a year later, I went to K2. This is in the Karakoram mountain range. Karakoram means black rubble in ancient Turkish. It's the greatest consolidation of high peaks in the world. There are 64 peaks above 23,000 feet high in a 100-mile area. Now you can imagine, you know, going any direction down the freeway 5 miles and then pretend you're going straight up, and that's how high these peaks are. This is K2, and on the right-hand side is the Abruzzi Ridge. This is the first attempt on the mountain 100 years ago in 1909 by the Duke of Abruzzi, an Italian gentleman. He was wearing hobnail boots, and being a gentleman, he even wore a tweed jacket and a tie when he was climbing, and he was eating cans of sardines. Here's an avalanche, and just to give you a size of the scale of this, if you look way down in the right foreground, you can see four blue tents, and if you had a magnifying glass, you could see four Spanish men in their underwear running out of the tents. Now, unfortunately, nobody was killed in this avalanche. Here we are going up the west ridge of K2, and on the right-hand side is Pakistan, and on the left-hand side is China. Finally, 78 days later, it was time to go home, and I didn't quite make it to the top, and I was quite disappointed. And it was, when I went into K2, I was so focused on getting to the top, but I didn't realize that it would really lead me to a far greater journey, and that was to help the children in Pakistan. Well, I had to, those of you who read Three Cups of Tea, can anybody here, somebody in the last group, one person remember, but anybody here, can you remember what the first chapter is called? Very good. Who said that? Put your hand up. Okay, give that person a big round, whoever said that. Failure. Did everybody hear that? Failure. When I submitted the original manuscript to Manhattan, to the publisher, they said, Greg, in the U.S., you never start a book with the word failure. But actually, I won that little decision because I insisted that I have that word to start the first chapter because, you know, we all make mistakes in our lives and we all fail and we can learn from those mistakes. Some of us burn cookies in the oven. Some of us fail in our relationships. Some of us fail in our tenures. I was in Wall Street in January, and I mentioned that some of us fail in our investments, and nobody laughed there. Anyways, at least we can laugh about it here. So next time you fail, think of this very beautiful Persian proverb that says, when it is dark, you can see the stars. So leaving K2, I had to walk about 58 miles. I stumbled down a rocky trail, and I came into a little village called Corfe. When I got into the village, there was a very elderly, stout, stern man, the village chief, Haji Ali, with a silver beard. First he said, Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be with you. And then he looked at me, and he shook his head, and he said, Chizale. Now, being from the Midwest, the best translation I can think of the word Chizale is, what the heck? You know, I was weather-beaten, my pants were ripped, and I hadn't taken a bath in 84 days. He said, you know, before you come to our village, you do need to wash up. Anyhow, I washed up in the icy river, and I went to his house for tea. I've now spent 17 years working in rural Pakistan and Afghanistan. I've spent about 75 months in the field, and I've learned many things. One out of three children born dies before the age of one. The female literacy rate is in the single digits, and many of the men leave the villages to get jobs in the cities. But who's left behind? It's the women. And the women tell me now their workload has doubled in the last 2-3 decades. Well, I spent some time recovering their incredible hospitality, and one day I walked behind the village. I saw 74 children sitting in the dirt during their school lessons. There were 5 girls and 79 boys, and most of the kids were writing with a stick in the sand. And although I'd grown up in Africa and seen a lot of poverty, when I saw those kids, they really touched my spirit. And as I looked around, I didn't see a teacher there. Can you imagine a classroom here where 3 days a week a teacher would be in another village, and it's because they couldn't afford his $1 a day salary. So I made a promise to a young girl named Chocho that I would help them build a school. And, you know, I had no clue what it would lead me to. So go ahead here. I came back to the States, and I've gotten a lot of flack for this, but, you know, life is kind of messy sometimes. And so I went to the local library to figure out how I could raise $12,000. Is there any librarians in here? Oh, give them all a big round there. There you go. Good. Teachers and librarians, you are my heroes. And I'm glad in New Hampshire, the earlier group, everybody put their hand up really high. Some librarians only put their hand up a little bit, so I'm glad that you support your libraries here. Anyways, in the library, we looked up the name of 580 celebrities and movie stars, and then I went and proceeded to, over 10 weeks, hand-type 580 letters. Dear Michael Jordan. Dear Sylvester Stallone. Anyways, guess what happened? Nothing happened. And then at Christmas time, I got one check back from Tom Brokaw, the newscaster, for $100. Now, Tom has recently moved to Montana, and he's had us, we've met a few times. He had us over to his ranch for dinner recently. He's also been a big help with Three Cups Tea, but he's kind of been avoiding me. So I asked Tom, you know, why are you avoiding me lately? He said, well, I'm kind of embarrassed, Greg, because everywhere I go now in airports and other places, people pull me aside and ask about this Three Cups of Tea thing, and I'm embarrassed because I wrote you a $100 check, and you wrote about it and stuck it in the book. Now, I didn't quite have the guts to say, you know, Tom, you could still write another check, and we'll stick it in the next book. Anyway, sorry, the book's already out, Tom. But thanks to Tom, now he helped significantly with our work. And to add some insult to that, my daughter, Amira, who's in eighth grade, we were doing homework the other night, but she was kind of distracted, and she looked up at me and she said, Daddy, I figured out that in 1993, you spent $128 on postage, and you only raised $100. Anyways, that's what math does for you. So I kept working and working to get this funding for the school, and by springtime, I'd raised $3,000. And my mother, who was an elementary school principal in Wisconsin, she invited me to come and talk to the 600 kids in her school. It was the first time I'd spoken to anybody, adults or kids, about what I was trying to do. And when I got done, there was a fourth grader. His name was Jeffrey. And Jeffrey came up to me, and he looked at me deadpan. He said, I have a piggy bank at home, and I'm going to help you. And I didn't think anything of it. You know, what can a fourth grader do? Anyway, 6 weeks later, Westside School and Jeffrey had raised 62,340 pennies. And, you know, when you think about it, it wasn't celebrities, it wasn't adults, it was children reaching out to children halfway around the world. And really, what can a penny do here? You know, not really much. Maybe you can buy half a Tootsie Roll in the little store down the street. But in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Africa, with a penny, you can buy a pencil. It's not that a pencil is so important. What education does, though, it gives a community and it gives a child hope. And if you have hope, you can do anything. I also talked to an economist at San Diego State University last year, and for some reason he studies pennies a lot, but he told me there are enough pennies in the U.S. that we could do one of two things or half of two things. We could double our national education, public education budget for 1 year if we could just round up all those pennies. But I encourage you, if you do that, don't send it to D.C. Just keep it local here in your school district. And number two, if we wanted to, if we could round up those pennies, we could eradicate global illiteracy. 120 million children in the world who can't go to school, 78 million are female. And it seems like a lot of money, but it only costs about $6 billion a year for 15 years. We could eradicate global illiteracy. you know, not this is not the U.S., but the global investment. Every single child could have the right to go to school. So from that little penny drive, now we have a program called Pennies for Peace. And for lack of better words, it's kind of going bananas lately. Last year it was in 278 schools. This year it's in 4,500 schools. And we not only encourage kids about helping and sharing and giving, but we also encourage kids to spend time with their elders. And I started thinking about that. I visit about 200 schools a year in the U.S., from private schools to public schools and urban and rural schools, and from kindergarten all the way through the Air Force Academy. And when I visit schools, the first question I ask students is, how many of you have talked in great detail to your grandparents about the Depression or World War II or the Vietnam War or the Civil Rights Movement? And generally in the U.S., only about 10% of the hands come up. And those are your teachers. Try asking your kids that sometime. If you ask kids in Afghanistan or Pakistan the same exact question, 90 to 100% of the hands come up. And I think it's one of the great tragedies in our country that we've lost that the oral tradition, where we can learn from our elders about our heritage, our folklore, our culture, and many of the traditions and even the lessons that we've learned in a historical context. Also with Pennies for Peace, we, and a lot of business schools ask me, you know, like, what's your strategy or what's your program, you know, what do you call that? What's your development program with Pennies for Peace? Well, we don't have any. We just let kids do it. The other thing we encourage kids, we encourage kids to do it on their, you know, to go out and do something on their own. And so what's happened with Pennies for Peace, it's got these thousands of kids now going around the U.S. doing these amazing things. This young man, his name is Zach, he's from Tampa. He's 11 years old. He did Pennies for Peace for 2 years, but 2 years ago he was bothered when he saw some homeless kids in the Tampa area. So he started an organization called Little Red Wagon Foundation. This year, Zach walked from Tampa to Washington, D.C. He raised $78,000 to bring awareness to homeless kids in the U.S. And next year, in the summertime, I'd like you to tune in to the Little Red Wagon Foundation. It's on the internet. Zach is going to walk from Tampa to Los Angeles across the U.S. He plans to raise $1 million to bring awareness to homeless kids in the U.S. And when Zach called me up a couple years ago, he wanted to set up his nonprofit, and he asked me about board directors. You know, is it like a board person? Or I said, no, it's, you know, it's like a moral compass and fiduciary responsibility. And Zach said, could I put some kids on my board? And I said, well, I don't think there's any law against it in Florida. So today, all of Zach's board directors have to be under 18 years of age to be on Little Red Wagon Foundation board. This young woman, Anna Dodson from Colorado, she's an orphan who came from Peru at the age of 3. Now she's 16. She did Pennies for Peace for 3 years. But a couple years ago, she started thinking about her fellow orphans in Peru. So she has an organization called Peruvian Hearts, and she and her high school classmates are running an orphanage for 120 orphans in Peru, and this is entirely run by high school kids. This young man, his name is Garrett Weiss. He's from Danville, California. He's now 18 years old. He did Pennies for Peace for 3 years, but a couple years ago, he was in Johannesburg, and he saw kids living in the ghettos in cardboard boxes, and what bothered Garrett most of all, though, is kids had nowhere to play. So he started a foundation called fundafield.org. Last year he raised $58,000 and he started 5 soccer fields in the ghettos of Johannesburg. And next year he's going to build 12 soccer fields for the kids living in the ghettos. And again, these are entirely kids doing things on their own. Well, the more I do this, I'm convinced that education should become and should be our not only our national but our top global priority. You know, we've got a bunch of teachers in here. That's great. You know, we can drop bombs, we can send in troops, we can build roads, we can put in electricity, but unless girls are educated, a society will never, never change. And several studies show that educating girls does 3 important things. Number 1, it reduces infant mortality. Number 2, it reduces the population explosion. And number 3, improve the quality of health and life itself. And I think number 2 is especially important. We have a lot of problems in the world today. We have global warming. We have environmental degradation. We have wars over oil and water and energy and land. But I think one of the main problems, if you look at where we're headed in 3 to 5 generations, is there's just too many people on the planet. And the number one way to curb population without doing anything else, you know, nothing controversial, nothing political, is simply female literacy. And the best example is Bangladesh. In 1970, the female literacy rate was less than 20%. Today, it's more than 60%. And if you look at a population graph, you can see in Bangladesh, it's just reaching an apex, 2.8 live births for female. 40 years ago, it was 8 births per female. And unlike Pakistan, Pakistan is the fourth fastest big growing country in the world. It's going to double in population in the next 27 years, from 175 million to 350 million people. And the only thing that Pakistan has never done in its entire history is have a national initiative to ensure that every single child can go to school and commit some serious GDP to education. And until that happens, nothing will change in a country like Pakistan. Also, when girls learn how to read and write, they often teach their mother how to read and write. Boys, I guess we don't do that quite as much. You also see people coming home from the marketplace, and they have meat or vegetables wrapped in newspaper. And you'll see the mother then very carefully unfolding a newspaper and ask her daughter to read the news to her. And it's a very powerful for a woman to be able to understand what's going on in the world around her and also understand about, you know, political issues and about exploitation of women through a newspaper. It's a very powerful way to empower women. So now I've got some really bad news and some good news. And here's the bad news. In the last 2.5 years in Afghanistan, the Taliban have bombed or destroyed or burned or shut down over 850 schools. And actually, this number is higher. It's about 1,000 schools now. And in Pakistan, about 600 schools. What's interesting, though, is that about 90% of those schools are girls' schools. They're not boys' schools. So why is a group of big bad men with weapons, why are they so terrified of little girls going to school? Because I think their greatest fear, it's not a bullet, but it's a pen. And what they fear the most is if that girl goes to school, gets an education, grows up, becomes a mother, the value of education will go on in the community. And in the Hadith, which is a part of Islam, it says that the ink of a scholar is greater than the blood of a martyr. It means that the pen is more powerful than the sword. And now I've got some really good news. I'm not sure how many of you are aware of this, but the number of kids in school 9 years ago in Afghanistan at the height of the Taliban in 2000 was 800,000 kids, mostly boys. Today there are 8.4 million children in school in Afghanistan, including 2.5 million females. This is the greatest increase in school enrollment in any country in modern history. How many of you were aware of that before I told you? Where did you hear about it, ma'am? Something in the book. Okay, good. Or in some article. Okay. You know, I've asked about 500,000 people that in the last year, and only about 50 hands have come up. I was briefing 5 senators in February, U.S. senators, and after I told them this, they were patting themselves on the back, and I asked them, you know, how can you take credit for something you don't even know about? But, you know, that's a politician for you. And of course, they, you know, we deserve some credit, but the real reason is because of the fierce desire and tenacity for education. That communities everywhere and mothers, they want their children to be able to have that opportunity to go to school. I've received also hundreds of letters from people serving in the military. Can you go back one? There we go. Including General David Petraeus. And he sent me an email last year, and he said he had read 3 Cups of Tea, and there were 3 important lessons that he had gleaned from the book. And being a military general, he summarized them in 3 bullet points. He said, number 1, that we need to listen more. Number 2, we need to have respect, meaning we are there to serve the good people. And number 3, that we need to build relationships. So now, today, 3 Cups of Tea is mandatory reading per Admiral Mike Mullen, Chairman, Joint Chief of Staff, for all senior military commanders. It's also mandatory reading. It's also a mandatory reading for all special forces deploying to Afghanistan, and then about 2,000 officers in counterinsurgency training at the Pentagon. Many other commanders have read Three Cups of Tea, and what they didn't tell me about is, I just found out last month, is that their wives read the book first and said, honey, you ought to check this out. This is Admiral Mike Mullen. He's the chairman, basically the boss of the military, Joint Chief of Staff. He sent me an email last year, and he said, I'd like to just be frank and forward with you, but all I hear about is bad news from Afghanistan. So could you come and visit me at the Pentagon, share a cup of tea, and tell me some good news? So I went to the Pentagon last year, and I've had several meetings with him now. And when I got done, he said, I told him some good news, and he said, would you mind if I came over and visited one of your schools? And I said, well, I'll check with the local elders, but I'm sure they'd love to have you. So July 14th this year, we were in a very remote village in Pakistan, and over the horizon came three Black Hawk helicopters. And out of the first helicopter jumped Admiral Mike Mullen. And we had a wonderful day, and we opened up Pushkar Girls' School. Admiral Mullen, I have a tremendous respect for him, and he's a very visionary leader. He gave a speech at the American Legion National Convention in August in Louisville, Kentucky. And this is how he opened up his speech, but he said that we, meaning the USA, we've been far too arrogant in the world. We need to go out and serve with humility. The Muslim community is a subtle world that we don't fully and don't always attempt to understand. Only through a shared appreciation of the people's culture, needs, and hopes for the future can we ourselves hope to supplant the extremist narrative. We cannot capture hearts and minds. We must engage them. We must listen to them, one heart, one mind at a time, over time. Admiral Mike Mullen. This is this gentleman, his name is Colonel Christopher Kalenda. He's from Nebraska. He's got four kids, just like a lot of you. He's a history major. He's also serving in the U.S. military. And for 16 months until last August, he was a commander of the forwarding operating base in Nare in Kunar in eastern Afghanistan. It's one of the most difficult, dangerous posts in Afghanistan. Several of his men were killed in firefights with the Taliban at Kamdesh and Korangal a year ago. He sent me an email about 2 years ago. We've been in touch ever since then, and now he's the team leader of General McChrystal's Strategic Command Team. And this is what he said in his email. He said that, I am convinced the long-term solution to terrorism is education. This is a conflict that will not be won with bombs and bullets, but with books and ideas and imagination that excite the imagination towards peace, tolerance, and prosperity. The thirst for education is palpable, and it is education that will make the difference, whether the next generation grows up to be educated patriots or illiterate fighters. The stakes could not be higher. Colonel Christopher Kalenda. This is my two kids, Amir and Khyber, opening up a girls' school in Chunda Village in Pakistan 2 summers ago. This is was a very difficult area to get a girls' school started. We spent 8 years to convince a mullah to send one girl to go to school. So 2007, we opened up the school. There were 74 girls there. Today, there are 350 girls going to school in Chunda Village. Three years ago, I was in East Houston, which is a pretty rough area, and I was visiting a fourth grade class, and the poor kids were trying to read the adult book, Three Cups of Tea. So I called my wife up, and she said, honey, you ought to write a children's book. So we did that, but we also, at home, I have a pile of about 2,000 criticisms and complaints and, you know, all kinds of things about Three Cups of Tea. So I actually went through them very carefully, and the young readers book, and also in the new book, Stones into School, we have a timeline, a glossary, who's who, more charts, more diagrams, more photos, you know, more everything. And also, 20 pages by my daughter, Mira. One of the questions asked of Amira, she's now 13, but she was asked in this, the young reader's version, so what's it like the day your dad leaves to go overseas for several months? You know, what's it like? So Amira writes, well, we wake up, and we're kind of sad, and then we take daddy to the airport. We give him a hug, We cry a bit, but not a ton. And then we go to school, and as the day goes on, we get happier because we know when we get home, Daddy will be there because he missed his flight. Anyways, that's a true story. Okay. So, Laura, I will be going off, and then Laura will be joining me, and we'll discuss some of your questions, and Laura will have a little dialogue. But most of all, I'd really like to thank you, and I also think that's important that we have one of the things I really think that it's important that we dial into. We have actually very visionary military leaders. We also have some really good people working, and there's a lot of good news that I'll share with you in a little bit happening in Afghanistan. Also, I think that it's important that we don't live in fear, that we live in hope, and also that we don't have our children, we don't exude that type of trepidation in our children, that we have hope, and we teach our children that they can live in a world of peace. But I really think it all begins with education. So thank you very much, and we'll see you in a couple minutes.
Well, welcome everyone, and what a great night here at the Music Hall and Writers on a New England Stage, and what a pleasure to have Greg Mortensen with us. It's great.
Thanks, Laura. Thank you.
Well, Greg, you write in this new book, Stones into Schools, about the incredible, incredible response that you got from average Americans all across the country in support of your work after Three Cups of Tea came out. How surprised were you by this just wave of reaction?
Well, it's Laura, it really surprised me quite a bit. I wrote a book, Three Cups of Tea, for several reasons. One, I wanted to talk about what we're doing. And number two, I also wanted to share some of the good things that are happening. And I also wanted to write something so that when my kids grow up, they'll understand that why their father was gone so much. I mean, that's really the most painful part about my job, is I'm gone from my family half a year. What's your original question?
Well, just that. How surprised were you? I mean, I think there's something funny in the book where you say, I couldn't believe I was getting such audiences when I was working at REI, I think it was. I would have loved to have had, you know, six people listen to me talk about hiking boots.
Well, and it's been an incredible blessing. It's also very humbling. Our support is from, across the board, from liberals, from conservatives. We get thousands of people in the military helping us out. Only one senator is writing checks to us, but he's helping out. It's been what I really found, that Americans were really good people. We're also very generous people, And we're also, I think, people of courage and conviction. And I think also it shows that really, you know, it's okay that we have differences of opinion, and it's sometimes sad to see how polarized we've gotten over politics and other issues. But education is something that can bring us all together, and so it's been really a great joy to, you know, and I'd like to thank everybody for the incredible support that we've gotten from so many people.
This book is about your efforts in Afghanistan, following up after Three Cups of Tea, about your efforts to build schools in Pakistan. Tell us the story, if you could, Greg, please, about how you got involved in building schools in Afghanistan. It's a very dramatic story, you know, right out of a Hollywood script.
Well, speaking of Hollywood, we've had 85 offers for a film, but I'm not planning on doing a film, so we've turned them all down. And the main reason is I don't want to jeopardize the girls in our schools. I feel that it might, you know, the sensitivity, and it's a real something that we have to be very careful about. The story, Stones into School, starts out with some Kyrgyz horsemen. These are a tribal group in the northern east Pakistan who come over a mountain pass, and they ask me for help to build a school. They heard about our efforts to build school. And they were emissaries for Abdul Rashid Khan, who's the commander in the northern areas. And these are kind of like Montana cowboys, but they had on big high boots and capes, and they had ridden for 6 days nonstop in order to ask to build a school. And then they asked me to come and spend the whole winter with us, and I said, well, I got to go back home to be with my family, but I promise I'll build a school for you. And in the end, it took us 10 years to get to their region. And eventually, I never even made it to their area, but we finally got a school built there this year. But it was imperative, even though I was determined to do it, that we had to build relationships. And so a lot of Stones into Schools is kind of about the decade of relationships it took to get a school built for the Kyrgyz people.
You call Afghanistan, right up front, one of the most ethnically complicated countries on Earth. Greg, just describe that complexity for us so we can appreciate it.
Well, it's complicated, but it's also very beautiful. Our website is called ICAT. ICAT is the silk of Central Asia, and it's each strand is individually dyed and then woven together. And Afghanistan is every valley you go, there's different ethnic group. The language changed from valley to valley, and it's kind of been the waxing and waning of empires. And Alexander the Great and the Mongols and the Ottomans and Genghis Khan and the Turks and the British and now the, you know, the NATO and the Americans and the imprint left by that. And so I see it as complicated but also very fascinating. And it's also imperative that we build relationships. And also one thing that binds the people together is their traditional respect for elders. And that's the one thing that I think that the U.S. we could do a little better, and that we really need to empower the elders and start to build relationships with them if we really want anything to change in Afghanistan.
Well, and you write about how you had to find the right people to help you build those relationships. You knew the lay of the land in Pakistan, but you didn't in Afghanistan. And yet you do have this great way of recruiting local people who you can trust, who are totally, totally devoted to this cause. How do you find these folks, Greg? I mean, some of them you up front say, no self-respecting non-government organization would give these folks, you know, not even a first look, never mind a second look. How do you find them?
Well,
and know that they're right.
I have a very either unique or crazy way of hiring people, but it's kind of often it's on the spot, and it's also based on intuitive kind of feelings. They're also many of our staff, I call them the Dirty Dozen, but half of them are illiterate. They come from very difficult backgrounds. Sofras Khan, who's kind of one of the main characters in Stones into Schools, an ex-Pakistani Army commando who had his hand shot. And I hired him because I saw him driving a Jeep. He has a mangled hand. He was driving. He was on a cell phone and smoking and talking to people next to him at the same time. And I thought, this guy can do some good work for us. And he turned out to be... He turned out to be the real Indiana Jones. Three Cups of Tea on the back. I've been trying to take it off for 4 years, but the publisher says I'm Indiana Jones of fighting in the Taliban's backyard in a remarkable humanitarian campaign. But the real ones, they're the people over there, and it's our staff, and they're the real heroes.
Well, let's talk about the Taliban. One of the schools that your group is working on right now is located at what you could call Command Central for the Taliban. Where is this, Greg, and how's that project going?
Well, we've had our best year ever this year. We were able to set up five, the first girls' high schools in five provinces in Afghanistan this year. And again, it's based on relationships. The specific area you're talking about is in Uruzgan province. It's in the southern area. It's the home of Mullah Omar, who's the leader of the Taliban. And last year, our staff fairly brazenly said that they, in 20 years, would set up a girls' high school in the home of Mullah Omar. It was kind of a little bit of a joke, but also kind of a challenge. And this spring, we heard from the Shura. These are the elders in Uruzgan province. They wanted to come and visit us. They heard that we're helping build schools. So we said, sure, come and visit one of our schools. They then came to Char Siav Valley. I don't have a picture here, but there's a picture in the book of the Stones of Schools, but they have black turbans, very fierce-looking men. They're armed to the teeth. And when they got to the school in Char Siav, we have a giant playground in the girls' school. So when they got there, they put down their weapons. For the next hour and a half, they went on the swings and slides and had a glorious time. You know, turbans flying all over the place. And then when they got, you know, I said, now, okay, let's get serious. You know, you need to meet the headmaster and look at the curriculum. They said, no, we're totally satisfied. We want a girls' high school in our province. But you need to come and visit our province. So in September, I went to Tarankot, Uruzgan. We had a big jirga, it's like a tribal meeting, and they've started now in the school. They started construction. It's the first girls' high school in the whole province, but they insisted on putting in the playground first, so that's my only worry, is that they're going to be using the playground. And, you know, it's a little bit humorous, but also I think it's really important that it was the relationships that really sealed that, and there's been a tremendous amount of efforts by many organizations and the government to get girls' school started that never succeeded. And, you know, thanks to a playground and some very some bold men that now that province have a girls' high school.
And to the philosophy that you have of local buy-in, local employment, local everything.
When we set up a school, Laura, that's good. Thanks for reminding me. We provide the skilled labor, the materials, and most important of all, the teacher training or support. And I think really, you know, teachers are the backbone of the school. But the community has to provide free land, free resources, free wood, and then free manual labor, 2,000 to 5,000 days of free manual labor. And what that really does is ensures the local buy-in. And it's also the reason I think that our schools aren't being attacked by the Taliban. We've had one school attacked, and should I share that story quickly?
Absolutely, please.
Okay. This is in Lalander Village. 2007, we had been getting a lot of threats from the Taliban. These are night letters that they put under the door and were threatening the girls' families going to school. They cut down the apricot and cherry trees of the girls' families who were attending school. And so summer 2007, 14 Taliban attacked the school. They beat up the night watchman. And the next day they said, if anybody comes to school, we're going to shoot you. Well, the headmaster got on his bicycle. He pedaled 23 miles. And he notified the local commandant. This is like the local militia leader. Now, Commandant Fahim, he's kind of I call him 50-50. You know, he's a little shady, but he also has two daughters in school. So he rounded up 120 men. It's called a lashkar. Lashkar is like a posse or vigilante. He came in, he attacked the Taliban, he killed two of them, and then he very quickly extracted information from the other Taliban. I have to be a little careful how you say that. And anyways, he found out they had gotten $3,000 from the local mullah to shut the school down. So now the mullah's in prison, along with three Taliban. And Commandant Fahim has appointed 12 askar. Askar are like a tribal militia to guard the school 24/7. And their orders are, if anybody harms any single girl or teacher in the school, you just shoot them. Now, that's not how we run a school, but that's how they want to run the school, and so everything's fine. And they haven't come back again.
It does make me wonder, Greg. It does make me wonder. There are, there are other stories like that in the book of local people not liking what the Taliban is doing, wanting their girls desperately to be educated. So why do you think it is that we also hear that the Taliban are resurgent?
Well, there is a resurgency, and the Taliban have kind of their, they were a little more, previously they were a little more ideological. Today they become more criminal, more mafia. They're getting less external or funding from other countries. They're getting more money now from illicit lumber trafficking, heroin trafficking, from kidnapping, from extortion, and from crime. And there's also many factions within the Taliban. They're not this monolithic entity that we might think of, but rather a bunch of factions who are competing against each other. I was at Camp Lejeune, which is the U.S. Marine base where 2,000 U.S. Marines were about to deploy to Afghanistan this summer. And I found it interesting that some of the Marines now, before they go to Afghanistan, they have to go embed with a gang in Los Angeles for about 4 to 6 weeks before they go to Afghanistan because they find a lot of similarity in dealing with gangs and that kind of mentality and fighting against the Taliban. And so, also, the shura, as I mentioned before, these are the elders. They actually are able to somewhat control the Taliban or work with them. And again, I think it's so important that we work with the shura. These are the elders, and that we put them back in power. The central government is very fragile, very fickle, and that started to happen. The U.S. military, for example, started setting up forward operating bases in very remote posts in Afghanistan about 3 years ago. But their primary mandate is to build relationships with the people. And if you went to a forward operating base 3 years ago, you'd find in the control room a grid that would have, you know, we have 120 men here, we have 50 machine guns and 100 grenades, etc., and the enemy has this kind of firepower. But if you go there today, you'll see in the grid a matrix, and it has all the key powerful people in the region, the head militia leader, the tribal leader, the religious leader, and they are trying to understand how all these people work together and really work on those relationships.
They're getting more appreciative of how very important that is.
Right.
I have a lot of questions from the audience that I want to share with you, and several along this one line, Greg. Your response to President Obama's decision to send 30,000 troops to Afghanistan?
That's the only question I get asked nowadays.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I have some, I'd say, I'll answer that a little bit, maybe with three parts. The first thing is what concerned me or bothered me or disturbed me was the fact that the decision to deploy more troops was made behind closed doors. There were 9 meetings. They were held in secrecy behind closed doors. The media was involved. There was no testimony on Capitol Hill, which I would have liked to have seen. I would also like to have seen the media being able to have access to those meetings. The second thing is that bothered me is that the shura, the people of Afghanistan, they were never consulted with this. This was entirely made by a few political leaders and some military commanders, and I wish that we had consulted a little bit with them. On the other hand, I do know that, for example, General McChrystal, who is the ISAF or U.S. military command in Afghanistan, since May we've been helping facilitate meetings between the elders and General McChrystal and his transition team. And for those of you who you've heard a lot about the McChrystal Report, but I really encourage you to actually read it. It's only 68 pages long, and it's similar to a master's thesis in sociology or anthropology. It's a lot about it. It's about building relationships, nothing really, you know, high-level military. And so General McChrystal and his team have met a lot with the shura, and we've helped to facilitate that. And we did this on behalf of the shura, actually. They wanted to meet with our military commanders. And some of the things the shura are saying are, number one, the thing that they loathe the most is they do not like bombings and killing of civilians. They say even if you kill one Taliban, but if one civilian is killed, it's not worth it. And they say we'll go get them ourselves. Some other things they're saying is that the central government is very, very corrupt. They're also concerned that what they want is brain power, not firepower. And I haven't found many people in the U.S. something I'd like to share with you that maybe you're not aware of. But many of the troops who are being deployed, they're actually trainer troops. Of the 22,000 troops deployed to Afghanistan earlier this year, 8,000 of those are trainer troops. These are horticulturalists, agronomists, veterinarians, doctors, nurses, accountants, and many other professions that are helping the people get back on their feet. Of the 30,000 troops going to Afghanistan, now I think 8,000 are going to be trainer troops. And I think it's those are the kind of people that the Afghan Shura, the Alawites, actually want them there. But they also say that we don't really need firepower. And unfortunately, I think with the disdeployment of 30,000 troops, the fighting is going to escalate. There's going to be more attacks. Our casualties are going to go up. And the American public now, we're going to have to really decide if, you know, if it's worth the price and should we really be there or not.
Has the administration, this is another one from the audience, asked for your input on the Afghan situation?
Not the administration, but the military has significantly done that. And again, I don't go out trying to promote what we're doing, but I've been asked by the military, so I've talked with the military. But as far as the administration, we haven't heard back yet. And I also, you know, comparing, I think in many ways the military is far ahead now. The State Department, our political leaders, our top three military generals have been in Pakistan, Afghanistan more than 36 times in the last year. Hillary Clinton and Joe Biden have been in Pakistan once and Afghanistan once just for a few hours, and they met with the Karzai and a few of the military, but they didn't really spend time with the people. And it's absolutely imperative, you know, I stress this again and again, that we have to start meeting with the people and the elders and sure and start listening to them and work with them to form a solution. I really think there is a solution, but we're going to have to start really, you know, drinking three cups of tea together.
Here's another question from the audience. Have you met Hamid Karzai, and what is your impression of him as a leader?
I met Hamid Karzai. I've also met Abdul Abdullah. I met President Musharraf, President Benazir Bhutto, and Nawaz Sharif. I think Hamid Karzai, he cares deeply about his people. He's also, you know, and this is, I'll just say on behalf of the people in Afghanistan, there really is a lot of animosity towards not only the president, but the governors. And I've been, you know, many people tell me that a governor needs about $1 million in order to secure his job. And then they have to get very lucrative contracts in order to pay back the money. And again, the people in the provincial areas feel very left out. And part of that is that when the U.S. and 18 countries got together at the Bonn Convention in December 2001, and that was where we determined how to rebuild the country, but it was set up as a centralized, deprovincialized type of system. Now, some of you out there, you might remember after World War II something called the Marshall Plan. And I think the Marshall Plan was a brilliant plan. The architects who designed it were genius. But the main component of the Marshall Plan was that it was provincialized and decentralized. And in Afghanistan, we completely flipped that around. And only recently have we really started to realize that we have to work, you know, from the bottom up or from the provincial areas. And I've met Karzai a couple times.
I want to go back to a theme that you mentioned earlier in your presentation, and that's the theme of failure. And in this book, there are a couple times, Greg, where you say you feel utterly powerless. You can't do certain things you want to do, either to your own health or the other situations, you know, that just come up. How do these, though, without giving the story away, because I don't want to do that, how do these so-called failures of yours in this book turn out to be their own kind of blessing?
Well, I've learned a lot from mistakes and failures, and some of the best lessons in my life have been from failures. And I also think back on, as I've made decisions, what has really worked. And usually it's the more intuitive decisions. The decisions I made over a very linear, logical process have often not gone very well. And in my bathroom mirror at home, I have a quote. I've had it for about 20 years. It says that when your heart speaks, take good notes. It's by Judith Campbell. And by the way, I was at an American Library convention last year, American Library Association convention. A librarian came up to me and she said, "Do you know who Judith Campbell is?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Well, it was Kennedy's mistress." So anyway, but I still have the quote on the mirror.
It's still a good quote. We got a couple questions from our audience at New Hampshire Public Radio that I want to ask you, Greg. And here's one from the fourth grade class of Abby Mather. She teaches fourth grade in Chesterfield, New Hampshire. And her class read Listen to the Wind, which is a children's book based on your work in Pakistan. Lots of great questions from the kids. Here's one from Will. He says, "How are the children in Corfe doing?" That's the village that you were rescued in Pakistan.
Well, thanks, Will. And the children in Corfe are doing really well. A lot of the kids who I first saw sitting in the dirt in 93, they've graduated. Some of them are teachers. Some of them are nurses. Jahan, who's mentioned Three Cups of Tea, she became a maternal health care worker. She went back to her village, but now she's in graduate school studying policy administration, and she wants to get into politics and become a senator. She's very ambitious, and she wants to affect national policy. And I try to visit all our schools at least once or twice a year, and the kids in Corfe are doing very well, and it's always a special joy to go back to Corfe and see the place where we started the first school.
Here's another one. It's more about you. It says, "How do you maintain your energy and focus of your mission? How do you keep exhaustion at bay?"
Well, I'm human. And life sometimes is messy, and I do get exhausted. My main blessing is I have an incredible wife named Tara, and Tara's been. Those of you who read Three Cups of Tea, I met Tara and. September 95 at a fundraising dinner in San Francisco. It was getting very late. I walked to the back, and there was a beautiful woman. She had on a dress, but she was wearing black combat boots, which was really what the key. And anyways, I started talking to her, and 6 days later we got married. And so, but Tara has really helped me. She's a clinical psychologist. She also is very practical, and it's also very difficult. I'm gone half the year, and Tara says, she calls it functional denial, but when I'm gone, she has to kind of run the whole show and also know that, you know, something might happen to me. And I actually get quite a bit of criticism. People say, you know, you had the responsibility to get, you got married and now you have kids and a wife and you're off traipsing around the world. But my daughter, Mira, who has a black belt in Taekwondo, but she takes great offense to that. And she says, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of kids in the U.S. whose parents are serving in the military or humanitarian work or aid work, and they make the greatest sacrifice of all. So, you know, how dare somebody say that my dad is not a good dad or something? And I think, you know, there are many kids who are making that sacrifice.
Here's another one, a person who has a friend who is in Afghanistan now as a soldier just outside Kabul. This person says the Afghan people have already made an impact on him. He's amazed at how little they have, but how happy they are. Do you have words of wisdom for him in his role as a young American soldier?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank... Is there a name there? Is it a,
no.
Okay, I'd like to thank the person for their service in the military. I also would like to say that we have incredible military leaders right now and very visionary leaders in the military, and I've had the great honor to talk with many of them. Also, they're very practical, and if you talk to General Petraeus or Admiral Mullen or General Conway, who's the Marine Corps Commandant, they will all tell you that there is no military solution in Afghanistan. I mean, they'll tell you that right to your face. They say the solution is a much broader solution. They really get it also, that it's about relationships, it's about listening. And Three Cups of Tea is actually a little bit critical of the military. I call them laptop warriors when I was in the Pentagon after 9/11. But I really think there's been a tremendous learning curve, and I feel it's a great honor that I've been able to spend time in the military. It's also very difficult in the military because now the military has to wear three caps. They have to be a diplomat, a humanitarian, and a warrior, and that's a virtually impossible task but they're accepting that responsibility. There's also in many areas there's a need for security, but also there's a need to reach out to people. And so I really feel fortunate that I think we have incredible leaders in the military and all of our servicemen and women. They're doing a great job.
I have two last very quick ones for you, Greg, please. This person says, you were nominated for a Nobel Prize, which went to Obama. Would you have accepted if it was you?
Oh, President Obama. Oh, well.
Were you nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize?
Yeah, some politicians nominated me, and then they held a press conference afterwards. It's supposed to be like a secret, you know, like nomination. But anyways.
You thought politicians would keep a secret?
But I actually, I'm kind of glad because I'm really busy. We got a lot of work to do, and my my son Kyber, I was in St. Louis when the announcement was made, and my son Kyber ran down in the morning, asked my wife Tara, who got the Nobel Peace Prize, and my wife rolled over and she said, well, President Obama. And my son started cheering, and he was happy because he said, you know, I'm really happy now because my father will be home more, and if there's one reason that I'm really glad it didn't happen is because I can spend more time with my son Kyber. So that's a I guess that's it.
Last question for you, Greg. Who would you like to really sit down and drink three cups of tea with at this point in your life? Would it be Obama? Would it be Hamid Karzai? Would it be Taliban leader Mullah Omar? Who?
I like to have three cups of tea with all of you out there. So that's everybody here. And, you know, ultimately also it's people who bring peace. It's people like you and all the good people here. And I'd like to have three cups of tea with everyone in the audience. That would be great.
That's a lot of tea.
Yeah.
Thank you, Greg.
Thanks. Thanks, Laura.
Before we go, thank you for that great applause. I need to let you know that the Music Hall and New Hampshire Public Radio present Writers on a New England Stage with Yankee Magazine in collaboration with River Run Bookstore, and that the executive producer and live stage presentation director is Patricia Lynch, that the New Hampshire Public Radio president is Betsy Gardella, that NHPR's broadcast producer is Keith Shields, the associate producer is Tom Holbrook from River Run Bookstore, the associate producer and director of strategic communications is Margaret Talcott, the live sound engineer is Edward Gruder, the recording and mixing engineer is Mike Marchand, and the music director and our band is Bob Lord and Dreadnought. And thanks again to our wonderful guest, Greg Fortenson.